Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. Last time on M2M.
You take somebody who interprets something, and then somebody reads it, turns it into opinion, and it just cascades.
This week, GMOs and using similar science to fuel an argument.
If I want to be like, science, boom, GMOs are safe. You know, if I want to say that, then I can't deny climate.
Part two with Nicole Steckline of Monsanto as we get back into marketing is a subject more vocations should embrace.
We deal with questions that come into us about, well, what do you know about the side effects of all of this? And you know, surely there's got to be something. And, well, you've clearly rushed that through to get it there. How do you know that it's not going to cause a problem in 10 years or 20 years? I mean, have you done that extensive study? And we get those questions quite often.
Yes. And so I like to just bring up the fact that we have three agencies that we have to satisfy. It takes longer and more testing to bring a genetically modified organism to market than it does a new pharmaceutical drug. And that's because we have to satisfy the EPA to make sure that it's not going to have any, you know, effects on the environment or the ecology, or particularly in the case of BT, we have to make sure that it's not going to kill any pests that's not the one that we want to kill. You know, we have to satisfy the FDA to prove that it's going to be safe. And for the reasons that I stated before, I truly believe that it is safe. There's just, what is it going to do? You know, it's deactivated. And then we also have to satisfy the USDA, as well as all the other countries around the world that are going to buy our corn product. They have to decide that it's safe as well. So there's more testing that goes on. And I think that anywhere, whether you're in the propane business, the anhydrous business, there's more regulation than anybody realizes. There are so many loopholes that you have to jump through. So there's the fact that it has to be very well tested beforehand. But I think what we're running into now is if there's a little snippet that shows something bad, somebody will take that and run.
They find the small thing.
Yes.
And make it big.
Yes. And I guess my question to a lot of those things is, do you believe in climate change? I'll ask you right now.
Well, you're asking a rhetorical or you're actually asking me?
Actually asking,
well,
and
because,
not so much global warming, but
yeah,
climate
change. I write a lot of weather stories for us.
Yep.
I look at a lot of these things, and I hear and see and I experience, and I can't say for certain there's one thing or another, but I certainly know that floods seem higher, temperature swings seem more extreme. We have 70 degrees in March when we should be having 40 more often than not. We don't see snow until January if we see it at all. I see certain things, but I don't know. If I listen to at Iowa State, if I listen to Elwin Taylor, he'll tell me it's a cycle of every 14 years of 21, they'll be unstable. We'll be stable for 7, then we're going to be wide for 7, and then we'll be stable for 7 again. And there's a cycle that we've just dealt with. So, okay, sure. It's just the way the weather has been.
Yeah, but,
so
but
I don't
changing.
Really have. Yeah, I think it's changing, but I also don't know if we're for certain in that part. I can't say that for certain. That's
yeah.
not. I don't think it's my job. It's just to present to you, hey, you know what? They've had 37 deadly tornadoes in Alabama this year. They've never had that before. Hypothetical, not saying that's
yeah,
really
happened.
But that's what we feel is an important part of our to our national audience to present certain things. That's one of the things.
Yep. And I think that when it goes into that conversation, science has come up with a lot of evidence
mm-hmm.
to support the fact that climate is changing. And there's also some evidence to say that it's not. But overwhelmingly so, science is saying that our climate is changing.
Oh, but I'm denying it. And we've had to deal with this in the last 2 years more mm-hmm. than ever. To say that science is bunk. Scientists can't get scientists usually, help me out here, usually can't agree to put their names on a piece of paper together. But when it's more than 95% agree on this, why all of a sudden should that be doubted?
Yes. And that is exactly my point, is that people believe in climate change because the majority of the evidence says that it's happening. So I'm going to use science as my reason for believing something. But when I look at something else, a different topic, I'm going to say, I don't believe science on that. And you cannot change the premise of your argument based on what topic you're talking about. So I can't say I'll admit, you know, I was very skeptical of the climate change thing or global warming or whatever you want to call it. And but I had an epiphany when I was driving around, because I drive a lot. But I had this epiphany where I was like, if I want to be like, science, boom, GMOs are safe, you know, if I want to say that, then I can't deny climate. And I think it works both ways, that if you're going to be all science, you know, climate change is happening, then you kind of have to agree that the overwhelming evidence is for GMO safety.
They're mutually exclusive for you.
Yeah. I'm a person of science. That's what I'm going to believe.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's your trip. What drives you to get into that? What drove you to start that?
Start what part?
Any of it. I mean, to get as passionate about this as you, I mean, we talked about your parents and the upbringing, but what drives you to continue to, as you said, put all these miles and do a lot of driving and go from place to place and share your story?
Yeah. Well, driving? I mean, part of it is it's my job. That's where so many of the miles come from. But I just want people to feel confident in their ability to go and do their own research. Don't listen to marketing. Go ahead and get to the point where you feel confident to read those scientific papers. I don't care if you come to a different conclusion than me. As long as you did your own research.
Read the source, not the discussion of.
I mean, we are bombarded by information. You know, Facebook, Twitter, the news, you know, how many different news sources, IPR, NPR, all that kind of stuff. And it is absolutely overwhelming. And not only that, but it's also human nature to select views or get news from a source that already has views that are the same as yours. You know, I'm a farmer. I like farming. So when somebody puts something anti-farmer on my newsfeed on Facebook, I'm going to unfollow them, because, you know, and it goes for everything. You know, if you were pro-Hillary, if somebody's saying how great Trump is, you're probably going to unfollow them. You either get on a Facebook fight or you were going to unfollow them.
Right.
So we tend to do that. But if you're going to just sink yourself in a shell and not look out, I mean, it's because it's extremely, extremely uncomfortable to question what you know. And I know this because when I was in retail, I was pregnant with our second child. And I mean, I stayed away from like the mixing bay and all the herbicide. You know, I made sure that I kept my distance, but you know that all the guys coming up were dragging stuff in on their shoes. So I probably had a fairly high level of exposure to herbicides, insecticides, fungicides when I was working there when I was pregnant.
Right.
And about that same time that study came out linking glyphosate and all this other kind of stuff to autism and cancer and all this other kind of stuff. And also around the same time, there was an older woman who came into my office, and she had a newspaper clipping, and it was an editorial piece about glyphosate, and she pushed it across the counter from me, and she told me how I was ruining the world, and how dare you, and shame on you. And, you know, obviously I could get defensive, but instead I decided to investigate. And like I said, it was uncomfortable as hell. Can I say that?
Yeah, you just did. Why was it? What was uncomfortable?
Questioning everything that you believe. I mean, we were farming. You know, just about every herbicide mix that I put together had Roundup in it. You know, and to think that what I was telling people to do really had a negative effect on somebody's life. Yeah, that's uncomfortable. But today I'm glad that I did that, because now I feel very confident in what we're doing and in the safety of it. Yeah, that was uncomfortable.
Have you re-engaged with that person to discuss that? Or after you did some research, did you?
No, I try not to engage too much of that kind of stuff, because if you're a certain person and you believe so heavily this, 99% of people are just going to hit you back as hard as possible. You know, if somebody is so far one way, you're not going to change their mind. It's just the way it is. Just like I've done my research and I believe very strongly one thing, go ahead and try and change my mind.
Yeah. Well, have you seen that? That's been a meme here recently on the internet about, it's some guy sitting at a table in the park, and it's a white white piece of paper, and usually somebody else puts something. It convinced me that Jenny and Forrest Gump was not an evil person. You know, mm-hmm. it's something like that's the premise. Convince me of what I think I know.
Mm-hmm.
So if I lived on a farm, never left the farm, or I went and worked for 2 years, or I went to college for 2 years or 4 years, and I have this certain set of beliefs. My father did this. My grandfather did this. My mother did this. My grandmother did this. Where's the point that those folks need to – should they be confirming what their beliefs are every 10 years, every 50 years? I mean, how do we make sure? I believe that GMOs have made that grape better or that apple better. How do I know that that makes my corn – now I have 3 years, not two. And now I have 16 rows, not 12. What's the responsibility on people in agriculture to confirm what it is they're doing to so they can go and do like you're doing and defend?
So you got to ask that again.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, does a farmer, I won't even say your husband, but friends around you, at what point do they need to reconfirm what it is that they believe is right and correct, and they're doing the right thing by using Roundup or by tilling, or, you know, whatever it is that you think is the common thing, because now we don't think tilling is the best for the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And for generations, it was, I got to plow it under every year.
We're always making new advancements. And I think that's the thing of it, is scientific communication and outreach. Because you aren't going to think about changing what you're doing until you have some piece of evidence that something else is better. And that's, I think that's the case when it comes to anything, mm-hmm. really. I mean, you aren't going to question what you're doing until you see somebody else doing it better or what you were doing failing. You know, seed corn fields, for example, very, very intensive cropping system. And if it's been in that rotation for a very long time, you can start to see some of the soil structure deteriorating because of some of that really high-intensity tillage. Well, when you start seeing that, then you start questioning, what am I doing that's wrong? You know, so unless you see a change, you're probably not going to question it, because if it's working, why fix it on one hand? But can we alter it to make it be better? And I think that's almost to where we are with some of the GMO stuff. If we can alter it to make it better, why aren't we?
Sometimes it comes down to dollars and cents.
Yes.
For people. How do you talk to someone who's like, the banker's only given me this much.
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford what I know is probably better for these 26 reasons. I can only afford this product. I can't afford this next one.
A lot of times it comes down to the farmer and his production practices. And marketing. Marketing has a huge part of it.
Marketing the grain, not marketing
Not us marketing to make them pay what we want them to.
Right.
At the farm level, the cure for low prices is more bushels. And I think we know that. You have to do what you think is right now, because we don't have a crystal ball. You know, especially these days, we want to do what's right long-term. I'll make cover crops an example. We want to do the right thing long-term, and cover crops cost money. You know, it costs money to buy the seed. Sometimes they don't even establish, so it was just wasted money. You know, you've got to terminate that cover crop, and a lot of times you'll end up with more pests and things like that because they're, you know, the moths are attracted to that green cover. But it helps soil health, but we want to do the right thing long term. But if we don't have a short term, what does it matter? So when we get into economic times like this, sometimes you have to make the short term decision so that there is long term. I think that's where that comes down to. So sometimes right now, a lot of us are just in survival mode.
Well, and that's the issue. For so many of, you know, I've talked to people about cover crops. We've discussed it on this podcast several times. And those that farm, that I know that say, yeah, I'd like to do it. I don't know anything about it. Okay, so I found an answer. Okay, there's so-and-so on the other side of that town. She can help you. Okay. I can't afford to do it. Mm-hmm. You can't afford to do it all. And then that's probably an old sales line. How can you afford not to help your family? You know,
you have to spray fungicide. You can't afford not to.
Yeah. Did that line ever work? Did anybody ever buy because of that?
I am not pretentious enough to say that. Sorry if anybody does. But it's, you know, it's when it comes down to the sales part of that, because I was in sales for a while, it's, you know, you got to understand that sometimes there's just a line. And people are different, too. Some people are going to push to get that top bushel. And other people are trying to make the most per acre. I mean, I guess that's what we're all trying to do. But, some, you know, you're going to accomplish it in different ways. It's just not every production practice, whether it's fungicide, hybrid, cover crops, is going to fit for every operation. For example, we inject a lot of manure. We have a lot of liquid manure. DNR wants us to incorporate it, right? Which is the best way to keep it on the ground. So we cannot do cover crops. Doesn't work for us. But there's other things that we can do to help stabilize the soil, you know, and other conservation practice that we can do. But cover crops won't work for us. Every operation is different.
Yeah, everyone's different. You've also gone in, you've mentioned you've gone into schools, high schools. Does your message change from elementary to high schools, or you're still talking when you talk about GMOs? And what's the pushback you get from some of those smarter kids that are thinking they're smarter?
So I've been lucky where the high school kids that I've gone to were FFA groups. So, you know, they were on the side, kind of. We actually went to Decorah and talked to about 140 seventh graders. And I was really impressed by them, and I was impressed by some of the questions that they asked. One gal said, are there any and she wouldn't look me in the eye, so I'm assuming that she had a knowledge level about the topic. So she was kind of looking down, and she goes, are there any consequences to this? And I was like, well, what kind of consequences? And then I just asked it back to her. I was like, given what I think you know, and given what I've explained, what do you think are the possible consequences? Because you got to think critically. You know, just like realizing that bugs and people are different. Think mm-hmm. critically.
Our pH levels are completely different.
Yes, and that's something that most people don't know.
2 and 10. See, I was listening.
I'll have to give you a quiz later.
Oh, let's see. That's about the only thing I might on some of this.
But I'll usually ask teachers, because usually we'll set it up over email. I'll say, you know, do they know about cell structure yet? And I'll ask kind of, what are they doing in science, in their science class right now, so that we can tie it back to whatever curriculum they're in right now. So we talked a lot about thinking critically. One of my favorite activities to do is to extract the DNA out of a strawberry.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's using all household items like soap and salt and rubbing alcohol and things like that. But it's about figuring out what level they're at in science and social aspects, you know, a lot of things that they're looking at in social studies, things like that. And then how can you tie the message in together so it fits into their curriculum and you're also teaching them something. But the biggest thing, no matter what age they are, is about critical thinking and doing your own research.
Coming up, your state fair attire could spark a conversation.
GMOs before hoes, and it had a picture of a garden hoe on there.
Conversations like this take time and resources to conduct. Please consider supporting our work by visiting iptv.org/friends. Thank you. Now back to Nicole Steckline.
You talked about marketing earlier, and if it would have been, if GMOs would have been rolled out differently than just for farmers. I've had this discussion with a few people before, and they talk about Europe. And in the EU, if the marketing would have been better to the general public, a lot of this that we've had pushback in the United States wouldn't have happened. Is that a fair – do you think Europe was the leader on the pushback on GMOs before the United States?
Yes, basically because that's kind of where Greenpeace came from. And I can't say that it would be different than today. It just might have happened sooner. But I think that – the consumers want transparency, And I think that's what really bit it, was that to some people, transparency or the lack of creates distrust. And that's what happened.
Well, and transparency from a corporate standpoint is an open window, they feel, to the competition.
Very true.
When you're saying a little bit of your science, and because one company sees it different than another, you have a lot of things you agree on, but everybody's kind of different and on certain things. Is it an industry-wide? I wouldn't even say industry-wide. I mean, who has to lead some of the pushback to say, hey, GMOs work. We're using less chemical here. You're getting better food that lasts longer. We are helping feed. I mean, who has to do that?
The farmer. Because there's already a lot of that distrust. You know, if I'm a door-to-door salesman, when I open my mouth, you're just going to assume that I'm telling you something to sell you something. So if I am Monsanto, if I'm Syngenta, if I'm, you know, any company that is marketing a GMO, the first, you know, when I open my mouth, you're just going to assume that I'm lying to you about it because it's how I make my money. Mm-hmm. And I think that that, I don't want to say it's a fair assessment, but it is a fair skepticism. It is how they make their money. So I think it has to come down to farmers and sharing their true life stories on how this has made us more efficient, how it has bumped up our yields, how it has decreased our insecticide use. You know, when you think about the airplanes that were flying around in the 60s, you know, A, they didn't have all the fancy GPS that we did, and pretty well most of those were spraying insecticide if they were doing it. So I think that if, I mean, we've got the proof on the farm how it works, and we just have to be able to make sure that we can tell, well, A, that we have a choice on seed. You know, there's a lot of people that think, well, I say a lot, but I hope it's not a lot, that think that, you know, farmers are forced to buy this stuff. And they're not. We have a choice. You can buy from whoever you want. You can buy non-GMO seed. It's a choice that you can make. You can go organic. It's a choice that you can make. You know, and just the it all ties back to being removed from the farm and not understanding what's going on there. So it's up to the farmer to communicate it, I think.
And I've seen different groups tell the stories of their producers, their clients, and things like that. And in some of those communities, it works because either they know that person or they're like, oh, well, that farmer I've never liked because of whatever reason. I've liked that one. That one's a little, you know, crazy. I mean, we all, you see it where you're from, both, you know, you live, and it becomes a marketing and a sale. In a way, you're selling public opinion.
Very true. Very true. And there's that part of it where if you are going to say what works as an industry, there's that marketing part of it. And then there's also the other part of it where the fear is emotional. And one of the issues that we have is that we want to use science and we want to use facts and we want to shove down your throat that we're right because look at these numbers. But that doesn't hit somebody on an emotional level. And I think that's where we struggle. And that's why we're trying to, you know, what's the pork thing now? The hog farmer
yeah.
thing. Hashtag real pig farmer is what it is.
Oh, okay.
That thing, you know, we're trying to, you know, reach and talk to people on an emotional level. I'm a family farmer. I have a lot of pigs, but it's a family doing it. So that's part of it.
I think it's in any walk of life. Yeah. I mean, a teacher has to justify their job sometimes when the school budget is tight. And or even in your own house, you have to say, I have to do this. But because of this, you have to market in any walk of life. You have to be able to market why it is important. We have to get on the air every March in public television and tell you why it's important to invest in us because of the value that we provide and the non-commercial side of things. And I mean, we're marketing ourselves to the public in an effort for donations. Just like a coach is recruiting. If you have a coach come in to recruit your son to play basketball, he's recruiting he's marketing his program and what it will do to help your son be a better person. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in every walk of life. So why is farming, why are we treating farming and agriculture any different?
Probably the level of distrust.
But where does that come from?
Remove, you know, I...
Because I'm not on the farm?
I can't almost even point to a single thing I think that has created that. That's a really good question.
I don't think there is one thing. I mean, I still think, think of the Super Bowl ad a couple of years ago and God invented a farmer.
Right.
How much the reaction was so incredible. I mean, the way we were first introduced is via Twitter. You see it on Twitter. You know that there are yesterday when we record this, the day before was National Ag Day. You saw there were great campaigns done by so many different people. But how many people outside of agriculture saw that? Did you see it in the news last night at 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock that yesterday was National Ag Day? You didn't?
No.
How many local television stations don't even have an ag report anymore? And they used to. Somebody somewhere made a decision, and I think a lot of that has all laid into that, because if it would have been, if you watch KWWL out of Waterloo, Iowa, Dale Hansen was the ag director for a number of years. When Dale spoke, you saw it at noon, he talked about it. It was an issue. It wasn't just reading the markets. You know, people talk about WHO and they listen to Mark Pearson years ago on the big show. That was their news. I mean, that's not the same as it once was. I guess that's my soapbox about it. I mean, I have discussions with people a lot, and it's, agriculture. I'm like, how do you not pay attention to it? Why are you not watching it? Do you not like to eat? Well, I don't eat that. You're not talking about sweet corn. But the product is in everything else that you use. And it's everybody, your state is built on it.
Yeah.
In Iowa and in the I states. I mean, I know we've got tons of people in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois and in Indiana. You don't think there's farmers in those states too?
But you don't see them. The average consumer doesn't see these people. So, and that's, I guess, circling back around to everything. That's the importance of getting out there and, you know, going into schools like I'm doing, because you get to talk to those kids that don't know, because otherwise they're going to become adults and they're going to go move away and be even further removed from the farm.
Before we recorded this interview, I told you I was running late because I had to go pick up my season tickets for the Iowa Cubs. I sit with my uncle, who's a lifelong farmer, and the guys around us, you know, they've heard the farm stories all for years. 2 years ago, when the Des Moines Water Works was suing the farmers upstream for the wastewater discharge, the Iowa Soybean Association was running advertisements inside the Iowa Cubs stadium during the season, during the game, about championing farmers and water quality. They brought it into the urban area, and I had never seen that before. Is that something that you think more of that needs to happen? Maybe not the lawsuit, but the education of what's going on in agriculture.
Yes, absolutely.
Who needs to do it?
Everybody. Use your social media and, you know, and any way that you can get it out there. It's just be open to those questions. You know, that's part of the campaign of the shirts that I had made.
What do those shirts say again?
GMOs before hoes, and it had a picture of a garden hoe on there. Mm-hmm. Specifically, now I don't give out those shirts unless I feel that you can speak intelligently on the topic. But that is specifically to wear to places like the state fair to spark that conversation. Because if I just wear a shirt that says farming is good, you know, no, but to actual, A, it rhymes, so it sounds cool. Right. It's a phrase that people are familiar with.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's a garden hoe on there, you start making connections. So, and I'm not saying that tillage is bad. Tillage is good. We got to use that for weed control and everything else. But just to help spark that conversation so that when you meet somebody on the street, they realize that you're connected with it. And then you can have a one-on-one personal conversation with them about that. And it's just getting that message to the audience that a lot of times most farmers on the farm, they're busy. They can't go to Washington, D.C. They can't go to the middle of Des Moines and just walk around the street and try and make connections with people who might spit in their face, you know? So it's doing things like that, doing like what the Soybean Association was doing there at the iCubs game. It's, you know, and then you look at the commodity groups. You know, they need a champion for our interests, just like anybody else. Everybody is a special interest group. I'm a special interest group for myself and for my family.
Yeah, absolutely. And people love numbers. Politicians love numbers. Voters love numbers. 7 out of 10, 1 out of 4, 2 out of 5, whatever it is. You know, when we say 1 out of 4 rows of soybean field in Iowa is going to China, that is something that the average person who doesn't understand farming can go, oh, wow. So, I mean, more campaigns like that will help us all greatly understand and appreciate and have a good back and forth. All right, anything else you want to cover before we wrap this up? I know I said just a few minutes, and here we go. But as you said, you can get going, Nicole.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's passion. I want people to know about their food, and I want them to feel comfortable, and I want them to trust it. But I also want them to do their own research. And to do that, you need to be scientifically literate. So, you know, our schools do a good job, but there's so much that they have to teach them. It's just go and do your research, even if you come to a different conclusion.
And you don't mean do research from a Facebook group
that already has
a bent.
Yes, absolutely.
Independent. Your employer, do they put out some of their scientific papers that you can read?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so anything that is put on record, the results of those tests that get submitted to the EPA, you can read those results, you know, and there's how many different testing that gets done after the fact. You know, you think about the network of farmers and commercial pesticide applicators over the last 11 years, I want to think, they identified people who had sprayed glyphosate and had a lot of exposure to glyphosate. They followed, gosh, it was a lot of people, so a lot of data points. And once a year, they would call them and they'd have to go in and get a physical because they were trying to find that link between lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and glyphosate. Because the only links, now we're going to go down another rabbit trail if you want to talk about IARC. But, you know, the only real links that they were able to find between glyphosate and Hodgkin's lymphoma was what they were creating in a lab. So when you want to think about the fact that we want real exposure, real world exposure on humans, well, we've already got the biggest experiment out there, all these people that have been exposed to it, and they couldn't find a link. So, you know, read some of that information. I mean, and not only that, but the size of the study. You know, if you got tumors to grow on 3 rats, that's not enough. That's only 3 individuals, and that's not a big enough data set. So, I mean, and that's what comes down to scientific and statistical literacy, is being able to read through that and say, there's something wrong with this experiment setup. The sample set's not big enough. This isn't very compelling data for one reason or another.
But somewhere on the review process, someone's going to say that, right? Shouldn't they?
So when it comes to scientific papers, there are some very well-accredited peer-reviewed journals. And then there are some that don't. I mean, just like any college where, okay, I went to such and such college, and they might be like, okay, good for you. It doesn't really mean, you know, we don't trust that accreditation. We don't trust that that institute. Same thing goes with scientific journals. You know, even if it's published, a lot of it goes into, was it peer-reviewed? Who was it peer-reviewed by? What society backs that publication? There's all of that other stuff.
Who was their funder?
You have to look at how the funding was given.
But anymore, that is how a lot of stuff is discredited, because they determine you got your money from SOA.
Your shill.
You got it. Yeah. And I mean, and that's a hard thing that we run into. As our state funding declines, we say, well, then it becomes harder and harder, because somebody doesn't want to give you a check if they can't determine, well, I want my viewpoint shared. Well, I'm sorry, that's not the way we work. And the same thing is in the academic field.
Oh, absolutely. Because when you look at it, government funding and public funding for universities, you know, who has the money? Industry does. Manufacturers do. Mm-hmm. So if you want funding for a project and you're not going to get it publicly or for grants or anything, you have to go to the private sector. And there's somebody on Twitter, Andrew Niss or Kiss or something like that. I don't know how he pronounces his last name, but he has gotten a lot of flack anytime he takes a pro-Monsanto stance, or if his results show something positive for, you know, one of the industries. They're always like, well, who's paying you? You know, who funded this report? But he has been, and he recently caught a lot of flack for this kind of stuff. But he has been very forthcoming with, and he's put it out there. He's published it. He's put it on Twitter, everything else. Who's given him money, how much it's gone for, and just the entire funding process. He's been extremely forthcoming with that and just stuff that I didn't even know. And it's, you know, look at who's funding it and how it's funding it. Be skeptical, you know, but because you're going to have to be, because there's crap information coming from, you know, both sides.
When someone writes you a $5 million check, they expect, no one gives money. The President Trump is right on that. When someone gives their money to that campaign, I expect you to be able to pick up my phone, when my phone call, when I dial your number.
Yep.
And that's money that's influenced politics, and it's influenced science, it's influenced media. It's just the way that the nature of our world is working a little
now,
bit.
Now, you say that money influences science. Are you saying that it influences the results?
Because of the money that comes in, because of, well, the university research, they used to be good. Well, now the university, that state's legislature has cut their money, and now they're going to have to find funding to keep these 12 people working. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Oh, I see what you're saying, where it has changed where science gets their money.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anything. I don't mean just science. I mean,
just basically anywhere, because state funding is going down.
And not just in Iowa. I don't mean that pick on Iowa. But, yeah.
Well, it's because it's very true in Iowa. Look what's happened to Extension.
Yeah. Right. Right. And that was there. Yeah, well, there's maybe another. That's another discussion for another time. Next time you come down to Central Iowa, maybe we'll continue this discussion and allow you to bring in to see how the results have gone, and we'll see how your campaign goes.
Yeah, I would love that.
All right, Nicole, thank you so very much for spending time here with us.
Yes, thank you.
If you've subscribed to the M2M podcast, you caught both installments of this topic. If not, what are you waiting for? I'm Paul Gager. Thank you for listening.